Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And now, here is your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, misunderstandings that are clearly resolved by adults, and other things, like free stuff, at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Coasting with me, Jack.
Yay!
How's it going?
Other than all of the pollen killing me softly with its song, pretty good.
It's not killing you very softly, Jack.
it's been rough.
Yes, it has. Hey, Jack, guess what?
What's that?
This segment brought to you by Tactical Night Vision Company. The night is dark and full of terrors, or at least it used to be. But now we have the technology to fight the night, and TNVC is your one-stop shop for all your dark fighting needs. From the TNV PVS-14 night vision goggle to the IR Patrol thermal monocular and everything in between, TNVC can outfit your defense against the dark arts. Doesn't matter if you've lost your keys, you know, the enemy, or that little kid from down the street that likes to wander off. TNVC has what you need to find things in the dark. TNVC, own the night. I almost messed that up, but then I pulled it out.
It was close.
Well, I just make that up on the fly. Hey, guess what?
What?
Tom Givens is joining us tonight.
Really?
Yeah, I know, which is great because Tom's awesome, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. Do we have anything that we need to talk about right now, or can we just get Tom on the
line? Let's get straight to Tom.
Okay. Joining us, Tom Givens. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you today?
Oh, I'm living the dream. So... I appreciate you taking time out of your Easter to come on the show, Tom, very much.
No problem. Glad to be here.
So for those that don't know or have not heard your previous appearances on the show, can you go over your background real quick, and then I'll hop right into asking you questions that I'm sure you're looking forward to.
That's awful boring, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like my shtick, though. I sort of have to, like, follow the script, I guess.
Well, as you know, I've been in the training business for about 40 years. I've been a full-time trainer for the last 20. Was in law enforcement years ago, and got into firearms training. Started out in that and then moved into it, as I said, full-time about 20 years ago. Had the good fortune to train with just about everybody in the business. Back in the day, trained with Jeff Cooper, Chuck Taylor, Ken Hackthorne, John Farnham, all the old heads, Clint Smith, et cetera. In more modern times, trainers like Southnart, Jeff Gonzalez, and a couple dozen others, which has allowed me to audit how a lot of different people teach and work the nuggets from all these different programs into our program, which has worked pretty well over the years.
Right.
Operate pretty much all over the country now as a traveling trainer, and be looking forward to hitting the road again next weekend, actually.
Well, there you go.
And, there's a lot more, but that gives you an idea.
Yeah, it's a short program, which is good for me because trying to come up with more than an hour at a time would probably be harder work than it already is. So I guess my first question for you is you've mentioned you've been doing this a long time now, 40 years. What are your thoughts on, I guess, sort of paying attention to like new things as they come along, or just sort of paying attention to the environment and seeing how things change? The thing that I've noticed about you, and I also sort of lumped Pat Rogers into this, is that you have done an extremely good job of staying current with things.
Well, thank you.
Well, it's been impressive, to say the least. So why is that, or can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, things evolve over time. The criminal threat has evolved. Terrorist threat obviously has evolved, but equipment has evolved a good bit over that time as well. A lot of times, technique is tied pretty much in lockstep to advances in equipment. I mean, if you look at dim light shooting techniques, for instance. You know, in, back in the day when we had Rayovac flashlights, we had the old FBI flashlight technique.
Yep.
Then we got second-generation lights like Kell lights and Mag lights, which were a huge step forward. And things like the Harry's technique and the Chapman technique were developed to go with that technology. Then we got the modern Surefire lights that put out so much more light in a much smaller package, and we're able to adapt to everything from the Rogers Surefire grip to neck index using the more modern equipment. So
right.
as technology has changed, the techniques to use that technology have changed, and it's good to keep up with that. If we did things the way we always had, we'd be carrying single-action armies riding a horse to work, and I'm not really interested in doing that.
Well, I don't know. I think you'd be able to pull it off. I might look a little silly in flip-flops up on a horse, but...
I can shoot a single-action army, but I can't ride a horse worth a darn, so...
Well, there you go. So why do you think so many people miss that? Specifically that the techniques are tied to equipment so closely, especially when we're looking at, like, historical context.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with a lot of training programs become what you might call inbred, especially when you look at law enforcement and large agencies, particularly the training personnel. We're trained by the training personnel in that agency before them. We were trained by the people before them. So it's really hard to get any substantial change done there. Same thing happens a lot in the private sector. You find somebody hang out a shingle and start teaching and immediately stop learning,
right.
Stop going to other schools. I have, over the years, trained with just about everybody, and even with all the hundreds of hours of training I've got, I still try to get at least one or two classes a year from somebody else, even though, as I said, I've been doing this professionally for right at four decades. There's still stuff to learn. For instance, I take Ken Hackathorn's advanced pistol class every 15 years because I want to see what has evolved, what he has come up with. There's always some new nuggets there. And if you don't do that, if you only stay in your own program, you get stagnant. So I think it's really important to be exposed to other things like that. If you look at equipment, for instance, when I went through the advanced class at Gunsight back in 1980, and I know you weren't born yet, that's all right.
Wow.
When I went through that, you had 1911, period. Glocks hadn't been invented yet. The SIGs, the HKs, the M&Ps, all the guns we take for granted, they did not exist at that time.
Right.
So we had a lot of techniques that really we don't want to use today because they were kind of 1911-centric techniques. Don't typically work well with other designs. So now that we've got a variety of perfectly usable handguns, we have to adapt the technique to that equipment. So I think it's really important to continue your training. If you hang out a shingle and stop learning, you know, I'm not interested in training with you.
Well, and that seems to be, and I don't know if that's a time thing that people do that or if they just figured that they've got the answer. We got to go to break real quick, Tom, if you don't mind holding the line.
Okay.
We'll get right back into it. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And this segment brought to you by Sig Sauer, the leading manufacturer of law enforcement military firearms, now with more options. We're not all the same, and our carry gun shouldn't have to be either. Sig Sauer gives you choices. With more models than the Bible's got Psalms, it's never been easier to find a Sig Sauer that fits your needs. From the extremely versatile Striker-fired P320 with modular grip frame, to the Legion Series P226, the single-stack P225A1, or the entry-level SP2022. Sig Sauer makes a model that's right for you. Just don't ask for Callahan full-bore auto lock. They don't make that yet. Sig Sauer, when it counts. And also, your premier source for Sig parts and accessories, TopGunSupply.com. TopGunSupply.com is your web source for fine firearms, parts, and accessories. True product specialists committed to delivering the highest level of customer support to you. They carry top-name brands including Ed Brown, Wilson Combat, Les Barrett, Sig Sauer, and many more, as well as premium AR pattern rifles like Daniel Defense. Whether you are looking to protect yourself, or a first-time gun buyer, or inverted, or a competitor shooter, TopGunSupply.com can satisfy your firearms needs. TopGunSupply.com. So we are joined by Tom Givens from Range Master. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm just fine.
So before the break, you were talking about the importance of instructors not getting stagnant and not, you know, getting stuck in their one doctrine that they teach and not examining new things. Which speaking of Daryl and Wayne are telling me I really need to come out in August because you're going to be out there taking a class with them, and I need to, like, learn how to shoot and watch someone that knows how to do it, doing it, I guess. And they were saying that you're pretty good, you know. So
that's a perfect example of what I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Wayne Dobbs and Daryl Bokey do a really excellent job of teaching both handgun and shotgun. This is a handgun class in August. And for one thing, it's a rare opportunity for me to actually get some trigger time, some focused trigger time with some coaching. You know, I rarely, as true of most professional trainers, I rarely get to shoot unless I'm demonstrating in class. And
right.
Demoing in class is not practice. So I treasure the rare opportunity to go out and actually get some good, focused, intensive practice with a competent person watching to look for errors and so forth. And they do a really good job of that. So that's an example of what I was saying, to try to get out and learn from other people. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, you were at the tactical conference here in Memphis.
Yes, I was.
I think that's just a absolutely excellent example of exposing yourself to a lot of different training philosophies and a lot of different nuances, and cross-pollinating ideas with other professional trainers, and really broadening your perspective. Unlike the person who sits back and just teaches his own program over and over again and doesn't go out and seek these opportunities. You know, we had 30 trainers, some of whom specialize in handguns, some in hand-to-hand stuff, some a medical trainer, classroom stuff from criminal psychologists. There was just such a wide interdisciplinary approach. You had hand-to-hand and knife work. So you're able to kind of step out of your little comfort zone and see what's going on in some of these other disciplines and how that interacts with your training, or how your training might need to be modified to fit into other things besides your own little bag. It's that's the kind of thing I like to see professional trainers doing. And we had quite a few there. Out of about 250 people attending, 3 out of 4 involved in teaching other people at some level, even if it's beginner and permit level class type things, or introductory classes for new gun owners.
Right.
Right on up through teaching SWAT teams and military spec op guys for a living. There were quite a few of those there too. So it's a good way to get that exposure to a lot of different doctrines, a lot of different ideas in a relatively small amount of time and a relatively small expenditure.
Well, and that seems, I wonder how much of it too is the fact that people are not wanting to put themselves out there or be, wrong, or are not wanting to embarrass themselves. I mean, I took Spencer's, Spencer Keepers, who is an amazingly talented shooter, makes really good holsters with Keepers Concealment. But I took his AIWB skills block on day one, and then I took the latter half of it on day two, just because that's how the schedule worked out. But in day one, one of the things I ended up doing was a shoot off between students where it's draw, fire 2 shots from concealment. And for whatever reason, number one, I was doomed from the start because Kirk was in that block and Kirk is a beast. Number two, Spencer's like, oh, John's really good. We're going to save him for the end. And of course, I embarrassed myself greatly by forgetting to grab the gun when I tried to draw it, which was apparently an important part of that step. I don't know. But it's just funny, though. I wonder how much of that is people just, they're relatively thought of well in their small little circle, and they just don't want to get outside of that because...
Yeah, they don't want to jeopardize that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had, as I said, about 250 people there, but 158 actually shot the match,
mm-hmm.
which means almost 100 opted not to. And I think a lot of those cases, it was because they didn't want to be in the bottom third.
Right. Right.
And, if you don't shoot, you can say, well, I would have done well. But if you shoot and you're 235 out of 236, then people might snicker a bit. So a lot of people can't take the snickering for it. So,
well, I don't know. Luckily, I've got people around me that are paid to make fun of me, so that helps. And Jack's like, yes, I am.
You get a bonus for it, right?
You do get a bonus for that. But
And I might point out, you have failed to point this out. Out of those 158 people that shot the match, you came in third.
Well,
congratulations.
Thank you, Tom. I've had some very good instructors, and I've had the opportunity to work out a little bit more than some people, But
people say, "Well, you got lucky." Well, no, not really. I know you put in the work. I've seen you in class a number of times. I know how serious you are about this. You know, Thomas Jefferson said, I believe in luck, but I found the harder I work, the luckier I get.
There is something to be said about that, but I will also point out that Spencer beat me by a full 2 seconds, and that Kirk, who I mentioned early, beat Spencer by a full 7 seconds, so me by a full 9 seconds.
Kirk's going straight to hell when he dies. He's obviously sold his soul to the devil.
Yeah, that's probably it. He is very, very fast. Next year, though.
I've had him in class a few times, and he's a remarkable young man. He's young, fit. He's got really, really good reflexes. He's got fast twitch muscles and slow twitch muscles. I've reached the age where I've only got slow twitch muscles.
Well, so once again, we were talking about, in Daryl's shooting block, he does the thing where you draw and fire as many rounds as you can inside of 2 seconds at the bullseye target inside of, I want to say it's like 5 yards or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was pointing out that some guy named Tom Givens got like 6 in under 2 seconds, not having shot that much and being kind of an older gentleman now. So I only managed like 4 or 5. So you're not too bad yourself. But
well, I've put in the time in the past. I don't get to shoot much now, but I did a fair bit back in the day.
Just a little. I guess my next question, since we're talking about getting to shoot and practicing and things like that, there's a recent, online thing where someone had misunderstood one of your quotes, or at least I think they had. But one of the things that you're kind of known for saying is that, and I'll paraphrase, that missing in a gun only hits count. Missing in a gunfight doesn't fix anything. And that's not to say that in practice you're not going to miss sometimes when you're trying to get faster or better.
No. What I say in class is that we simply can't afford to miss on the street for two different reasons. The first one is it wastes time, and time's your most precious commodity in a fight. If you die in a fight, it's almost never from running out of ammo. It's from running out of time. And you run out of time from fiddling around, what Farnham calls dithering. That probably the biggest waster of time, waste more time than anything else, is missing. Every time you miss, you used up the time to prep that shot, fire that shot, and recover from that shot. And that's a significant amount of time.
It is.
You're assuming, when you accept misses, you're assuming that you're going to get to keep doing this until you get a hit. The problem is the other guy's not having to wait his turn. His turn's concurrent with yours. So the more you miss, the more time you're giving him to launch bullets in your direction. Hell, you might get hit by just sheer accident. The other side of this, it's a two-way street. The other side of this is every round you launch at, it's going to go somewhere, it's going to hit something. In an urban environment, we just simply can't afford to be tossing bullets around the neighborhoods and hoping they hit the intended target. A trainer named John Hall, I always try to give credit to whoever I steal stuff from. A trainer named John Hall said that there in the field there's no such thing as misses. There are only unintended hits.
Right.
And, that's a pretty wise statement. You're going to hit something, whether it's the intended target or an unintended target, with every round you launch. It's not going to be a berm on the street, not going to be a berm on the Walmart parking lot. It's not going to be a safe direction. Your pistol bullet will fly a half mile, fired parallel to the ground at shoulder height. It'll go a mile elevated a bit, but we don't normally shoot it that way. We normally shoot it aimed at something.
Right.
Talking about 750, 800 yards of travel before it hits the ground the first time. In an urban environment, that's a long way. However, this does not mean that we never shoot quickly. The idea in practice is to push speed, go to the point where the wheels fall off, which means you're starting to miss, and back off just a little bit, work on fundamentals, then try that again, and you incrementally get faster.
Right.
The idea is to eventually get really fast and still be accurate. The notion that you can be fast or accurate is silly. You can be both. It just takes work.
Just a little bit.
The point is to get to that area. What I said, what was misconstrued and what misquoted and everything else was not to shoot faster than you can guarantee a hit.
Right.
I think the quote was, don't ever shoot faster than you can guarantee a hit. Well, they didn't say in practice or in fight. That's in a fight, not in practice. In practice, we need to push, find out where that threshold is, so then in the fight, we don't go faster than we're confident we can get hits.
Well, and that, I ended up making a video to point that out, and I was shooting at some 2-inch circles, and at a certain point, and I've been doing this a little bit now, and I get to shoot quite a bit, I know about how quickly I can shoot at any given range and hit any given size target because I've worked, that problem a lot, and I've had very, and it's funny enough, most of the times that I can I've really learned something has been what I've missed. You know, like at the advanced instructor class that I happen to be trying to get the record fast casino drill time and dropped one shot and didn't get it because it didn't count because I missed.
And had you gone about a tenth of a second slower, that would have been a clean run.
Yep. And
and that's another thing people don't understand. We're talking about fairly small increments of time. We're not saying take two more seconds.
Mm-hmm.
We're saying, I watched your particular run you're talking about. If you had taken about a tenth of a second longer, it's the last shot that you blew. If you take about the tenth of a second longer on that shot, it would have been in there.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, your nemesis, Kirk, has the record on the casino drill right now. He shot it clean in 13 and a half in the last class.
Well, we've got to go to break, which is good timing, and we'll talk more about my nemesis, Kirk, when we get back. And Jack's dying over in the... You're allowed to laugh on air, Jack. It's fine.
Dying here, man.
All right. You guys are listening to Ballistic Radio! Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Blue Force Gear. Doesn't matter if you're fast roping out of a Blackhawk, serving high-risk wards, or trying to figure out which aisle they hide the kale in. Who eats that stuff anyway? Blue Force Gear has a solution for you. Do you need a low-visibility concealed carry option? Check out their belt-mounted multi-use pouches that hold magazines, lights, and other tools close to your body while moving with you. Maybe you need a lightweight minimalist plate carry to throw on over top of your duty gear. If so, take a look at Blue Force Gear's Plate Minus. Maybe you just need a better way to sling your rifle. They've got you covered with the Vickers Sling. If you need carry gear, they make a way for you to do it. Blue Force Gear, always better. And Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat makes the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. So we are joined by Tom Gibbons, who is doing a really good job of making me feel not as good of a shooter as Kirk, which now I need to go and Tanya Harding him or something like that.
Ooh.
Anyway, so we were talking about before the break, you know, knowing how quickly you can shoot and knowing, you know, guaranteeing your hits pretty much and having the shooting discipline to slow yourself down if that's what you need to do. Or also, too, though, the importance of finding out where that speed is in training as well.
Yep. You don't want to waste time by taking more time for a shot than you need.
Right.
On the other hand, you are totally wasting time if you shoot faster than you can hit. So it's kind of a fine line. It's a balancing act. You know, in class, we do a lot of drills to reinforce the timing issues and really kind of drum that in. What I find everywhere I go, and I teach literally all over the country, what I find pretty much everywhere is most people only have one speed mm-hmm. to shoot at. They shoot at the exact same cadence, give a big target, little target, close target, far target, sounds exactly the same. And what that means is that there's only one distance out there in front of them somewhere where they're actually shooting at the correct speed. Closer than that, they're shooting slower than they have to. They don't realize it. And further away than that, they're shooting faster than they can get hits, and they're missing. So they're just totally wasting a lot of time on both ends of that. What we got to learn to do is speed up as the target gets bigger or closer and slow down as it gets smaller or further away. And then actually shoot an appropriate cadence for the amount of target we've got.
Right.
And that's entirely dependent on the size of the target. You know, we got a smaller target, slow down a little bit and hit it. You got a bigger target, speed up and hit it right now. But it's not something intuitive for most people. It takes a bit of work, which is why we do so many drills that involve timing. You know, everything from the parrot drill to changing the distance to the targets to various things we do to try to reinforce that mostly at a subconscious level.
Well, and it seems, too, that when people, you know, especially when they panic or when they start to understand that they're not hitting or maybe when they're just not seeing the effect they want on the target, they start to speed up.
When you're missing, the correct answer is never going to be to speed up.
Right.
When you're missing, the correct answer is always going to be get your wits about you, find the front sight, and actually hit the guy.
Mm-hmm. Here, let's change gears just a little bit. One of the blocks that you taught at the TAC conference that I did not get to sit in on, and I regret not being able to, but unfortunately I've not figured out how to clone myself and be two places at once, was identifying the threat. It seems like there's a lot of discussion about, you know, it's not that they're not possible scenarios, but they're not likely scenarios. Do you mind going over that a little bit?
Well, you have to look at realistically what is your threat and then prepare for that particular threat. What I find a lot of people doing is they go to classes taught by former law enforcement guys that's their only background, and the scenarios, the training tends to be geared toward law enforcement work, which has typically very, very, very little to do with civilian self-defense. They have a completely different role, completely different mission. They work, particularly police patrol officers who do the bulk of the shootings in this country, work in a completely different environment. For instance, most shootings involving police officers involve patrolmen, as I said, not SWAT guys and not detectives, unlike in the movies.
Right.
SWAT guys aren't supposed to shoot people. They're supposed to get them out. SWAT stands for sit, wait, and talk. They're supposed to get them out in one piece. Detectives can't shoot anybody because they never leave the office. So police patrolmen are the ones that actually shoot people, and they shoot people in typically one of three scenarios, either traffic stops, bar enforcement, or domestic violence calls.
Right.
Those account for an awful, awful lot of shootings involving policemen. None of those have any applicability whatsoever to a private citizen. Private citizens should not be stopping people for traffic infractions. They should not be hanging out in seedy bars full of parole violators, and they shouldn't be sticking their nose into people's marital difficulties while they're drunk and fighting.
Right.
Those are all just recipes for disaster, basically. So if you're looking at a training program built around law enforcement work, it's probably not going to work too well for the private citizen. You got a lot of trainers coming out of the military right now, and what a military door kicker can do in some foreign country and what you can do here in the U.S. under American civil and criminal law is a different matter entirely, and you need to keep that in mind. But then a lot of other differences. You know, the soldier's armed with a long gun, handgun's a backup gun to him. I don't know very many civilians that wander around with their long gun. You know, the joke that I'm going to use my pistol fight my way to my rifle is just funny to me because your rifle's unloaded and the gun's, say, 40 miles from here. I'm not exactly sure how you expect to go get it. That's true for probably 99.9% of civilians in this country. The two major differences between military and the private sector is, number one, the soldier has to understand and accept the concept of acceptable casualties. In any military operation, you're going to lose some on your side. You're going to try to make the other side lose more. But if you're planning an event from the squad level to the corps level, you've got to factor in casualties. Do I start with enough people that when we lose X percentage, we still got enough to accomplish the mission? We can't afford to do that. If you're in the mall with your family when the active shooter event breaks out, and you tell your wife, if we all do this or that, we'll probably lose Timmy, but the rest of us will be okay. I don't think she'll go for it.
Well, it depends on how Timmy's been keeping his grades up, I guess.
It depends on how Timmy's been lately. But the other main difference is he understands and accepts the concept of collateral damage. In warfare, it is unfortunate but absolutely unavoidable that non-combatants get killed.
Yep.
In our little world, the acceptable level of collateral damage is zero.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not just talking about killing people. We're about killing people, injuring people, damaging their property, emotionally scarring them. Hell, you might send them to their safe place with a trigger and get sued for that. So the acceptable level is zero. So that's a huge difference. A lot of the dot mil trainers that are coming out right now have had a really hard time making the transition to training civilians. I saw an ad from one the other day that said in big bold letters, "We will make you the aggressor." The problem is in American law, both in civil and criminal law, the aggressor is a synonym for the defendant.
Yep.
And a good way to wind up in jail.
One of my favorite ones that I saw was a close combat course that was sort of billed as a home defense thing. And they've got their course outlined that they've got with this ad. And I did some checking, and this guy is a legit guy that has done amazing things for our country, and I'm not taking anything away from him. But one of the things they were also teaching in this was body searches. And as far as I know, searching the bad guy that you just shot in your living room, you've now altered a crime scene.
Yeah, you're going to be charged with tampering with evidence at the very least,
yep.
If not more. And that's a good example. It's a different world. He hasn't made that change, hasn't made that transition yet. What we need to be looking for, if you're interested in civilian self-defense is, number one, look at what actually happens to people, not these goofy scenarios that people come up with on the Internet, but what actually happens to people. You know, look at, for instance, the Bureau of Justice Statistics puts out a report every year on crime in the United States. In the first place, most people have no idea how much violent crime there actually is and how it breaks down. And when you start looking at that, then you get an idea of what it is that we might need to train to counter. If I ask a typical person how many violent interpersonal crimes, and we're not talking about somebody stealing something or anything, we're talking about violent interpersonal crime like robbery, rape, aggravated assault, how many of those are there in a typical year? Your typical average person on the street, if I ask them that, they'll give you numbers like 20,000, 30,000. The correct figure is almost 6 million.
Right.
It's a huge, huge number. 600,000 robberies a year, 1 million aggravated assaults a year. And as you know, aggravated assault means somebody tried to kill you. They just weren't very good at it. It means you survived. In my city last year, year before last, we had 154 homicides. And so you can look at that and say, well, hell, it's only a person every other day. It's not that big a deal. It's not. And that's not the point. Those are the people that were hurt so badly that the trauma center here, which is one of the three best in the country, couldn't save them. They are the rare exceptions. We had 9,165 aggravated assaults in that same year. So every one of those, as I said, was an attempt to kill somebody. The med just saved them. Now, that doesn't mean they got off scot-free. They may be blind. They may lose a limb. They may be paralyzed from the waist down. They may have 8 or 9 corrective surgeries trying to fix their gut. So they didn't get off scot-free, but they didn't die, so they weren't a homicide. In fact, in the FBI Uniform Crime Reporting system now, there's not even a place for attempted murder anymore. It's just murder and aggravated assault. So if you die, it's murder. If you don't die, it's just an aggravated assault, even though you may be horribly screwed up for the rest of your life.
Right. Let me interrupt real quick, Tom. Just hold that thought because we got to go to break. Right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of air rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it, but how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it. And that's where Surefire comes in. From the USB rechargeable 300 lumen sidekick to the 500 lumen X300 Ultra or M600 Scout Light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell, "Aziz, light!" ever again. Doesn't matter if you're shining a light at a potential threat or just helping your friends see through their eyelids at the bar. When you need all the lumens for longer, you need Surefire. So we're talking with Tom Givens. Now, Tom, before the break, you were discussing the number of murders versus assaults. And I'm sorry for interrupting.
That's okay. Yeah, aggravated assault is extremely common. It's one of the threats we need to be prepared for as a civilian gun carrier. It's said you typically about 1 million of those a year. Well, that's one for every 300 people in the country. So it's not some 1 in 1 million chance at all. And that's just for that one crime. Now, as I said a minute ago, if you're shot, stabbed, bludgeoned, but you don't die, you'll be an aggravated assault. And that's how you'll go into the crime stats. But those aggravated assaults generally result from one of four root causes. And we kind of lumped them together as the four R's. That's robbery, rape, road rage, and respect. And if you get shot, it's probably going to be over one of those four things, with rare exception. So if you think about how the dynamics of those work out, in a robbery, for instance, what's a guy got to do to rob you?
He's got to talk to you most days.
Yeah, he's got to talk to you, right. He's going to be within a few steps of you. He's going to make some demand for your wallet, your watch, or whatever. It's a common misconception about this that these things happen at contact distance. The key word in armed robbery is armed. The whole idea of having a gun or a knife to stick up people is to terrorize them into compliance from a few steps away and then move in to take the goods once you've got them compliant. Typically, they occur at about 2 to 3 steps, which 2-3 yards, pretty close range, but so you can certainly miss at that range if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
That's why we need to really focus on getting the gun to eye level in both hands if at all possible and getting good hits, because you let him get off enough shots at that distance, you're probably going to get hit just because you occupy so much space in front of his muzzle. Rape is a serious issue. There's about 250,000 of those a year in the country. Road rage becoming far more common than it used to be. And last month here in Memphis, we had 3 people shot on the expressway in separate incidents, car-to-car shooting. And then respect You know, I couldn't tell you how many homicide investigations begin with, he dissed me.
Yep.
You know, he disrespected me in front of my peers. And this cuts across racial, cultural lines. You know, you've seen a video we play in class of a 43-year-old white male professional killing a deputy because he felt disrespected by him. Very common reason for assaults now, serious assaults nowadays. So if you think about the dynamics of those four main root causes, though, they all involve pretty much the same thing. The guy's going to be within a few steps. You're going to have a very limited amount of time to fix this in. And you're going to need to be able to produce your concealed weapon quickly and efficiently and get solid hits in those first few rounds. So that's pretty much what we really focus on in class.
Well, I think once again, so I guess where do you make the distinction between preparing for what's most likely and using that as an excuse not to practice other skills, which is what some people end up doing? And I know that's not something that you espouse.
No. What we have to do is apportion our time correctly and spend the most time on the things that are the most likely, spend some training time on things that are somewhat likely, and don't waste training time on things that are extremely unlikely.
Right.
For instance, we spend some time beyond a couple of car links because there are events that happen there. In the last few years, we've had three private citizen students of legitimate self-defense shoot at 15, 17, and 22 yards. Typically, what happens in a case like that is you're not defending yourself, you're defending a loved one. And if somebody's 15 yards away trying to kill your spouse, you don't have time to walk over there and fix it. You have to fix it from where you are.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened in one of those cases. A woman shooting to defend her husband. He's already been shot by an armed robber and is about to be shot again, and she engaged the guy from 15 yards away and hit him. Well, that hit her husband. Which I thought was pretty decent performance.
Well, and that brings something else to light, too, is that a lot of times I hear people say things like, you don't have to be that accurate. And they start talking about things like, combat accuracy or things like that.
Yeah.
And I understand what they're trying to say, but do you mind spending a couple minutes on that?
Yeah, there's a couple of problems with that. The first one is you're not always going to have a full value, 90-degree on, head-to-toe exposure of something you need to shoot. If someone ducks behind an object that bullets won't penetrate and you've got half a face and a gun muzzle sticking out around it, that's a small target.
Right.
Very small target. Maybe a car length away, but it's still going to be hard to hit unless you know what you're doing. Again, distance is a problem. In this one case where the student had to shoot at 22 yards, the guy's firing shots from the sidewalk on the other side of the street at our student who has little children in the yard with him. He has no choice but to engage the guy. So he took cover behind a car, got stable, fired one round, and hit the guy. Stopped the problem at that point. Hit him a good center high chest hit and stopped the problem. That's a long way. So you have to be prepared. Are they outriders? Yep. Do they happen enough that we'd be concerned about them? Yeah. We've had 62 shootings of students in the last few years that we know of, and those three I just mentioned, that comes out to like 1 in 20.
Right.
1 in 20 is enough that I'm concerned about it. So we do have to spend some time at that. The other problem, of course, is skill degradation. You're going to lose some skill under the extreme duress of somebody trying to kill you from a car length away. The more skill you have, the less you're going to lose. The less skill you have, the more you're going to lose.
Right.
To get a higher level of skill, you had to put in the reps. You had to put in the time. You had to do the work, as we say. And so with that repetition ingrains the skills to the point where you can still hang on to them and use them under a good bit of pressure. Yes, you're still going to drop some, but you're not going to drop as much as the duffer. The duffer is the one that turns into the flipper-fingered guy that can barely even operate the pistol, much less hit anybody with it. And we see that constantly. People who barely qualify in a law enforcement environment, for instance, they get out on the street and they empty a high-cap gun at somebody a car length away without touching him with a single round. They didn't have the skill to start with. They were just familiarized with a gun, if you even want to call it that. On the other hand, we find people who have a fair level of skill, who hang on to that skill and do quite well. The guy with the 22-yard shot had been to the range 9 times in the prior 12 months to practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be hard to convince me that didn't have an impact on that.
Well, and it seems like, too, that if we hold people to a higher standard and if we tell people that with work they will do well, then that is what they will do. Whereas if we tell people they won't see their sights, they won't be able to operate a magazine release or slide stop or whatever it is, that's what they'll do because that's what we've told them.
I've supervised people in the military and law enforcement and in the private sector, and I've taught guns in all three of those arenas. And I found that people perform at whatever level you require of them. If you've got loose, sloppy standards, guess what you're going to get? You're going to get loose, sloppy performance. If you have high, demanding standards, that's exactly the performance you're going to get. People are going to do what you require of them. Probably 5% of the people would work harder than you require them to because of a personal quest for excellence. That's one person in 20.
Right.
The rest are going to do what you make them do. What you tell them is required of them, what we expect of you, basically. You know, in every class you've had with us, whether it was a instructor class or just an operator class, we tell you right up front there are going to be some requirements here, some standards we expect to be met, and you're going to have to put in the work and meet them.
Yep.
And I believe that's how we turn out people that prevail in fights. You know, I mentioned we had 62. We've actually had 65 people that I know of. These are ones that have reported back or been reported back to me by law enforcement involved in gunplay in the last few years. And 62 won their fights. None of them lost their fights. The three forfeited their fights. They showed up without a gun and were killed.
Right.
But if you think about that, 62 out of 62 that had a gun won their fight.
Well, and most
so we must be doing something right.
Yeah, I would say so. And most of them too avoided serious injury as well, except for I want to say
and we had three out of 62 wounded, but they all recovered.
Right.
But that's only 3 out of 62.
Yeah, and that's not bad. That is not bad at all.
I'll take that.
Well, if people want to, we're coming up towards the end of the show. We got another minute or two left. If people want to train with you, find you. Where can they do that? How can they get signed up for the TAC conference in 2017?
Okay. Well, as far as contacting me, it's really difficult. It's rangemaster.com is our website. There's tons of information on there about classes. There are links to sign up electronically for the classes. A lot of information about each individual class and what we require there and our schedules, monthly calendars there. So pretty much that's the go-to source for information about our training programs. There's also a segment there for the tactical conference. Just click on that, and you'll see a lot of information about the 2017 event and both printable mail-in registration form or online links. Just go ahead and register online with a credit card. For next year, I don't know if you got the word yet. For next year, we'll be at the Direct Action Resource Center in Little Rock, Arkansas for the tactical conference next year.
I did see that.
Yeah, it's not a well-known complex because they don't do any private training. It's been there for 20 years, but they've trained military special operations people, federal government agents, and police SWAT teams over there. It's got several really elaborate shoot houses, 1,000-yard rifle range, a bunch of other ranges, got a helicopter mounted on about a 60-foot platform so people can jump out of the flaming helicopters and pretty much everything that you would expect in a training facility of that sort. And we've been fortunate enough to partner with them for next year, and that's where the tactical conference will be next year. So,
excellent.
You go to our website and click on Tactical Conference 2017. They'll show you some pictures of the facility and a little better idea of what we'll be doing there. We'll have, as this year, we'll have 30 different trainers conducting blocks over a three-day period, and you get to go around to these different blocks and take as many as you can fit into your schedule that you're interested in. So if you're only interested in gun stuff, there'll be plenty of that. If you're more of an interdisciplinary type, there'll be plenty of that. So it's probably the best bang for your buck in the entire training industry.
Perfect. And I highly recommend that people, one, go to the conference, two, get signed up now because it sells out really, really fast every year.
Next year is already 25% full.
Wow. Year,
yeah.
Well, and there you go. Tom, I appreciate it. Thank you so much, and I will talk to you soon.
Glad to be here. Hope to see you in class again soon.
Oh, yes, sir. Give Lynn my best. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
All righty. Bye. So, next week, I believe we're going to be joined by Andrew Branca from the Law of Self-Defense. Make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And hey, keep leaving those 5-star reviews on iTunes. We really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next week.